Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's Tuesday, February 7th. And let's see, let's look at the schedule. Then I got some general comments. The next test is February 21st. I think that's a Tuesday right off after a holiday. So Monday is a holiday that week, the 20th is President's Day. And then, which is great, because if you don't have to work all day, that means you can study all day long, which is wonderful. But if you didn't start studying before the 20th, then you have really poor chances on the test, right? So you should be studying all along in this class. Probably maybe a little bit every day would be really helpful. So today we're going to start a new chapter, Interactions Between Cells. That's chapter 6. That's what we're going to look at today. One thing that I noticed, because I go into Blackboard every once in a while and check and see how students are doing, and I've noticed in every lab there's almost a handful of students that aren't doing any work in Blackboard, didn't submit any quizzes, right? So I just want to make sure, and let's just say, tell me every week you have to submit an online quiz for course points, right? And what day is that due? Because you can take these quizzes an unlimited number of times before the deadline, but zero times after. When's the deadline? Wednesday, 11 p.m., right? So every week. I noticed, I talked to a couple students that were surprised that last week there were two weekly modules due because the first week was so short, all right, and they didn't do the second week. So how would you find these? Come on, cursor, let's go back over here. Where are you here? So you would find these assignments in where? Weekly assignments, right? So I just clicked on that. Here are the weekly assignments. So what's due on tomorrow, February 8th? It's going to be Chapter 3, Structure and Genetic Control, all right, and Chapter 6, right? So those are the two chapters in there. So a lot of people didn't do these first two quizzes. So what I'm going to do, because it was a little atypical, I'm going to reopen up as week number 2 so that you can take that quiz again. If you didn't get 100% on that quiz, you can go back in and take it. Make sure you get 100% on it, right? And I'll keep it the same deadline as week number 3. So by tomorrow at 11 p.m., right, you should be completely caught up. And guess what? That will be the only time that I open up a quiz, all right? So if you have any friends that you've met in lab and they're not doing their weekly quizzes online, there's no way to pass the class unless you do, right? Because if you don't take it, you get a zero. A bad grade, you can average out with other good grades, but you can't really do that if you ever get a zero on an assignment, right? Zeros, you just can't average back up to get a decent grade in the class. All right, so please don't forget about those online assignments. And are there any other cool things in these weekly modules? Yeah, the practice quizzes are really good. Sometimes there's videos in there with a little quiz afterward that can help you master the material. All right, so then the material for that first test is going to be Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 3, and Chapter 6. That's the first test, which is going to be on the 21st. All right, so I'm going to put that away. Let's see, what other announcements do I want to make? Oh, yeah. I've had a little bit of problem getting the lecture recordings available to you on that link, and so I troubleshoot that, and so probably this afternoon it will be working just fine. So somebody sent me an email, a couple of students said they're really interested in listening to the lectures again, and that will be available this afternoon. Okay, and there's a link in Blackboard for that. Okay, so that's all my announcements. Anybody have any questions? Yeah. Okay. Which quizzes? The lab quizzes or the extra credit quizzes or the online quizzes? Okay, online quizzes. Those you got to take, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Some people have taken a quiz maybe 12 times and it will take the highest score of that 12. Okay, as long as you don't leave a quiz open, if you just hit the X on a window, if you just close out of the window, Blackboard thinks that you're still taking the quiz, and it will think that way forever. So as long as you hit save or submit, okay, and I would just hit submit every time, then Blackboard knows how to keep track of it. Then it knows that you're done taking the quiz. If you leave a quiz open by hitting this little X button at the top of a window, then you'll get a paper and pencil symbol in your grade book instead of a number. And then I have to go in there and clear it manually. Okay, so that's a little bit of a hassle, not a really big hassle. I tell you when it's a really big hassle. For instance, if somebody takes a quiz 20 times because they forgot how to submit the quiz and they hit the little X button 20 times, then I have to go in there and clear it 20 times. Then it's a hassle for me. But if you just do it once or twice, it's not too big a deal. All right, so always click save or submit, and preferably for me, just hit submit. And then as soon as you hit that submit button, it's going to be graded automatically. So these darn computers make me look bad because I can't grade your tests quite that fast. Okay, but Blackboard can, so that's a good reason to hit submit. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
For the exam?
Yeah. Ah, the study guide. Yeah, the study guide. Did I close Blackboard down? Okay, so the study guide is all important. And where do we find study guides? Maybe course documents right here. Well, you get the lecture PowerPoints. Oh, you know what? Maybe I put it in a button. Did I put it in a button? Exam study guides. All right, I've got that right there, so click on that. And then, oh, I got some videos, so that's instructional material. Exam 1 study guide. By chapter. So it's a folder with a number of study guides by chapter. Click on that and it will download everything you want to know about what's going to be on the test. So it'll give you what checkpoints in the chapter that you're reading you should know. It gives you objectives of what generally you should know, then specifically gives you questions at the end of a chapter, which I might take and put on the exam or maybe modify it just a little bit. And where can you find answers to the questions that are at the end of the chapter? At the end of the book, there's answers. So you can check your information or you can come see me during office hours, either way. There are online questions that I like. And I enumerate which questions I like on the simple quiz, the difficult quiz. That's all in here. And then don't forget, a significant component of every test is graphically based, where there's going to be a picture and then you have a word bank that you have to match answers in the word bank to relabel a figure. And those figures are also given in the study guide. So you can see some of these study guides don't have very many pictures. Like this one here, you can tell because it's only 800 kilobytes. But then we look down for chapter number 2. This study guide is over 3 megabytes. That probably means it has a lot of graphics in it, right? So there are a lot of exam figures for chapter 2. But that really helps you master the material. Okay, so really good question. These are the things that you really want to focus on in your studying every week. All right, and the weekly assignments in Blackboard help you take steps in that right direction so that you master this material for the exam. And the labs, that all the exercises you do in labs, support lecture. And sometimes I'll even throw in an extra credit quiz in lab after lab that you have to draw something, right? And it's really, really helpful for you to be able to draw that information because then you have a nice picture in your mind that you can use to answer all kinds of questions on a test, right? So on a test, some students maybe answer the picture questions first, the images, and then they can use that as a guide to help answer the multiple choice and true-false and other kinds of questions on the remainder part of the test. Okay, so focus, don't forget to do the graphic learning for the class because that helps you on every aspect of the test. Okay, any other questions? Yeah?
Is the entire test on
Scantron? This first test has no written portion. So you do need a Scantron. Next, I'll bring in a Scantron. I think it's an 882 ES 884. I forget which one it is. 882 E or ES is really good. Excuse me. Get one that has the bubbles that haven't been shaded, just the clear bubbles, and get the ones where the bubbles are labeled A, B, C, D, E. There are some out there that are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but then you have to know what 3 corresponds to. And I know we could probably all figure that out, but excuse me, why waste time trying to figure something out? Just get the right Scantron. That makes it really easy to do that. Okay. And I know some people, a lot of people, are dyslexic. All right, and so when they look at a D and a B, it's really hard for them to tell that apart if it's a lowercase letter. But if you look at an uppercase letter, a B looks a lot different than a D, and all the answers that I have on my tests are in uppercase. So you don't have to flip letters around in your mind to figure out which one is the best one. Okay? Okay. All right. Any other questions? No, we're good? All right, so that means let's go to the PowerPoint right here, and I'll fix the screen in just a second after I get set up here. All right, so this is a pretty cool chapter because we're going to use some of the chemistry that we learned and actually learn some more chemistry, some more physical chemistry in this chapter. Arrow options, let's just stay visible with the arrow. I'll turn some of the lights down, and I probably want to do this. Sorry, I guess I like it like that. Okay, so here are some a list of topics that we're going to cover in this chapter. Extracellular environment. Oh, what kind of environment is that? Where do you find the extracellular environment? It's outside the cells, but still inside your body, right? Okay. And we're going to talk about movement across the plasma membrane, because plasma membrane will let some things through, but not everything. And that will involve osmosis, membrane transport systems. And as a result of that, that produces a voltage across the cell membrane. So we're going to talk about membrane potential or membrane voltage. And then how signals can how cells can communicate with each other by sending various kinds of signals from one cell to another. All right, so extracellular environment includes all constituents of the body outside of cells, but still inside your body. Okay, and the intracellular compartment inside of cells is almost 70% water. So most of our body is water, with a few things that are dissolved in water, and then some other kinds of proteins and compounds that can't dissolve in water. All right, but mostly we're just a baggie with water on the inside with some chemicals in solution that have dissolved inside that water. All right, the extracellular compartment, right, that's about 33% of our body, is made up of two spaces that you should be aware of. One space is extracellular fluid. Okay, or of the extracellular fluid, fluid outside of your cells, is what we call interstitial fluid. And interstitial fluid is contained within ground substance of a matrix. And it's just like a jelly or gel-like material that's found between cells in a connective tissue. The other place where we find fluid is in a connective tissue, but we don't really call it ground substance necessarily. We further define that term to be plasma. Right, so of all the extracellular fluid in your body, 80% is interstitial fluid in a ground substance, and another 20% is in the fluid part of blood, which is what we call plasma. And this is important because we're going to talk about how molecules move around inside your body. One important way is through a process called diffusion, where a molecule can move from high concentration to low concentration, and something funny happened. Well, what color is the light now?
Red.
Okay, that's not a good thing. All right, let's see if I can change a battery and talk at the same time. Oh, it doesn't matter because I don't have batteries. Okay, okay, diffusion is where you have a sorry, back there in the room. Can you still hear me okay? I'll try to speak up this way. Diffusion is a way for a molecule to move around its environment from high concentration to low concentration, but in order for it to move, it can only move through a liquid, okay, a fluid. And so one kind of fluid is a liquid, for instance, like water, and another kind of fluid is gas. So molecules can move by diffusion through the air, because that's a gas, or through a liquid like water. So most of your body is water, so molecules can move around really nice. But for instance, if we take this tabletop right here and stick a molecule in the center of the table, like right inside the tabletop, since the tabletop is a solid, what's going to happen to that molecule? Can it move around? No, because it's glued inside the tabletop. So diffusion can't happen within this tabletop, but it can within this room because it's a gas, or inside your body because it's a liquid. And you can see how important these liquids are in your body. I know there's a cursor here someplace. Oh, I saw it. I saw it. Here it is. Okay, next slide. Very good. So the extracellular matrix. And where do you have a matrix again? What kind of tissue has a matrix? From anatomy? A connective tissue has a matrix, right? It's the space that's the out, that's between cells in a connective tissue. Okay, so the matrix has ground substance, which are proteoglycans, the modified sugar and protein molecules that came together, as well as some fiber-type molecules like collagen and elastic. So you should be aware of the difference between collagen and elastic. A real easy question would be, which one is stretchy? Elastic, right? It gives a little bit, and then when you let go, it goes back to its original length. Collagen, on the other hand, is not stretchy, but how would you think of collagen? It's strong, right? It can't stretch, and it's designed not to stretch. It's designed to hold tissues together. All right, and then the ground substance, that jelly-like material, is like a sponge. It holds water in our body, and all of these things are kind of held together, right, and attached to the cell membrane of cells by integrins. Right, so integrins are protein adhesion molecules that link the intracellular and extracellular compartment together. They kind of hold your body together. And interstitial fluid of the extracellular compartment resides in that hydrated jelly-like material, which we call ground substance, which are modified proteins. And that's what this diagram shows right here. So I see a blood vessel, and I see an epithelium right here, right? And how would you know that this is an epithelium? The cells are really close together, and there's no blood vessels in it, which are characteristics. And then you would further, oh, it says because the slide is labeled over here, I wasn't looking over here. All right, and then you could classify it by your knowledge from anatomy. It's a simple epithelium, okay, and maybe it's cuboidal. Maybe I would say cuboidal. If they're flat cells, then I would say squamous. Here is a basement membrane, and then here's a connective tissue because I see a cell here and then another cell way over here with a matrix between them that contains a ground substance as well as some of these fibers. The fibers hold everything together, and what does the ground substance hold? It holds water, right, exactly. So that molecules can diffuse from one part of your body to another, for instance, maybe oxygen, right, or even fluid can leave this blood vessel, and then oxygen can make its way to these tissues over here. And the reason why is because you have water in the ground substance of the matrix of a connective tissue. Okay, that's what we're interested in. All right, now let's stop thinking about the ground substance and think about the plasma membrane. It's a little bit more solid structure, okay? The plasma membrane is selectively permeable. It allows certain kinds of molecules to pass through, but when we say selectively permeable, it means that not everything can move across the cell membrane. So the membrane is selectively permeable. It lets molecules into the cell that the cells need to maintain homeostasis on the inside. All right, so many important extracellular molecules have transporters or channels that allow particles to move across the cell membrane. All right, so here's one kind of transport. We call it carrier-mediated transport. It means that a molecule can't get across the membrane unless it binds to some kind of protein that makes up a part of the membrane. All right, it's a specific protein transporter. That process is called carrier-mediated transport. And then there's non-carrier mediated transport. Maybe a molecule can't get through the membrane, but if there is a channel, which is a protein that spans the membrane, it goes totally across the membrane, which then forms a pore or a hole in the membrane, then certain molecules can move from outside to inside or from inside to outside. So you got carrier mediated transport and then non-carrier mediated transport, right, which requires a channel. But if there are no proteins in the cell membrane, then carrier-mediated transport can't occur, or even non-carrier-mediated transport can't occur because there's no channel. Another way to think of transport across the plasma membrane, and this is a real important way to think about it, right, is by these two criteria right here. It can be described as being passive or active. Right? Passive just means that it does not require any cellular energy for that process to happen. Something can move across the membrane without requiring any energy from your body. What's the energy molecule inside your body? ATP. Don't know if we talked about that yet in this class, maybe, but for sure in anatomy we have, right? So passive transport does not require any energy. Compounds move down a concentration gradient. We're going to describe what that is today. All right, it just means that molecules can move from high concentration to low concentration. All right, active transport is another way, and that just means that ATP is necessary or some other form of energy. Usually, right, it depends on ATP in some form or another. Sometimes it's directly related, sometimes it's indirectly related to the ATP concentration. And active transport means that it can transport molecules from low concentration to high concentration. It can go the other way, right? But it's going to require ATP or some process that's linked to ATP. All right, so we were talking about molecules moving in your body by diffusion through water, right? And water is a very important solvent in our body. That's what our bodies are dissolved in. And it makes a solution of various compounds. So you got to know what a definition of a solution is. And I'm not sure everybody does, so let's just write down what a solution is. A solution has two parts, right? And a solution can't have just one part. It's got to have the solvent, and it's got to have a solute. A solvent is usually a liquid, right? And it's the majority molecule. It's the molecule that makes up most of the things that we find in a solution. So what's the solvent in our body? It's the molecule that our body is mostly made up of, which is a liquid. And that is water, right, from our previous discussion. So that's a solvent molecule. What's a solute? That's all the rest of the junk that's dissolved in the solvent. All right, so let's look at some of these questions. Have you used a solvent today? Okay, yeah, probably most of us have. And so... what about what solutes have you used today? Sugar, right? And so what's the solvent that you used? Like water would be the solvent, and we put coffee particles in it, and so the coffee is a solute. And if we put water with salt, with coffee molecules in it, then what do we have? We have coffee that we can drink, yes, but what is it called? It's called a solution, okay? So solution has got to have these two parts right here. All right, so what's the major solvent in your body? We answered that one already. What are some important solutes in your body? Like minerals, ions? Like what kind of ions? Sodium, potassium chloride, okay. And glucose, sugar. That's an important solute that's inside your body. All right, and proteins that are dissolved in the ground substance. Those are solutes as well. And gases like oxygen and CO2 that are dissolved in your body, those are solutes as well, right? So even gases can be solutes. So now what is the minor solvent inside your body? The major solvent we said was water. What's the minor solvent in your body? This kind of stretches your mind a little bit, okay? And this is kind of a new sort of exciting area in biology. Most of your body is dissolved in water, but you also have lipids. Where do you have a lot of lipids? In every cell membrane, right? Because of the phospholipid, the interior part of a cell membrane is lipid. And so your body is made up of two worlds. You have water world, which is the major part of it, and you have lipid world. And there are things that are happening inside that little lipid world that we're really interested in, but not till the later end of the class. All right, so lipids are the minor solvent. I thought that arrow wasn't supposed to disappear. All right, lipids are the minor solvent. There are things that can exist in lipids, and there are physiological processes that happen within inside that lipid world, which help maintain homeostasis as well. All right, What can dissolve in this minor solvent? Okay. Yeah, anything that's nonpolar, okay, can dissolve in that. So there are hormones that can dissolve in that because what were some of the hormones that we looked at? And what's a precursor molecule? Like steroid hormones, right, which is a lipid. So steroid hormones, right, can dissolve in that lipid world inside your body. Okay. And those are important hormones. All right, so let's talk about diffusion, which can happen within a fluid, either a gas or a liquid. And we're going to talk mostly about liquid solutions in this chapter because that's what our body is in most circumstances. All right, so diffusion is a random motion of molecules. So when we have a molecule just sitting in space someplace, it's not absolutely still. It's wiggling around. Other molecules are bumping into it all the time, all right, kind of jostling that molecule around. And even if you look at a red blood cell underneath a microscope, you see that a red blood cell is just not sitting there. If you're at high power, you'll see that a red blood cell is actually kind of jostling around because water molecules are bumping into it all the time, getting it to move. And that motion acts like a mixer, and it mixes everything up. All right, so diffusion is the net movement of either a solvent or a solute molecule from a region of high concentration to low concentration. So let's just say that these two chambers right here are filled with water, and then we dump some sugar inside of it. All right, so the dark dots are the solute molecules, and the molecules we can't see are the solvent. And let's just say it's water. And so on one side of the container, we have very little solute. On the other side, really high concentration of solute. All right, and so if we then take that barrier away, we see that these solute molecules over here are going to move to the other side of the container. All right, so that's just by diffusion, from high concentration to low concentration. All right, and can that continue forever? Okay, can that continue forever? Can you get all of these molecules over to the right-hand side of that container? Oh, you can't. It's going to stop, right, because diffusion is just a passive process. And when does it stop? When does it stop exactly? When does diffusion stop? When the concentration is exactly equal in both of these compartments right here, right? So it's the concentration gradient that is driving this motion, right? And then the net movement, I mean, some of these molecules might move to the left, but, right, the same number will move to the right. So we call that no net movement of molecules from one side to the other, all right? They're still going to move back and forth, but no net diffusion is going to happen. So here we have a more biological example. We have a cell with a plasma membrane right here. Nonpolar compounds can readily diffuse through the cell membrane. It can get inside of the cell because, remember, the cell membrane is made up of phospholipids, so it excludes polar compounds or any kind of compound that has a charge on it. Many compounds, important compounds, have a charge like sodium and potassium. And what about glucose, for instance? What kind of compound is glucose? Is it polar or nonpolar? So you should be able to analyze that by thinking of what the structure of glucose is. Okay? What kind of functional groups does glucose have on it? A lot of hydroxyl groups, right? And so you have a hydrogen bound to an oxygen. What kind of bond is that? Okay? It's a polar bond. I'm not a polar. Hold on a second. It's a covalent bond. It's strong. But what kind of covalent bond is it? If it's a hydrogen bound to an oxygen, or a hydrogen bound to a nitrogen, or a hydrogen bound to a phosphorus, it's a polar covalent bond, right? So glucose is highly polar, and polar compounds can't get through the lipid world inside this plasma membrane right here. So glucose can't get inside the cell. But oxygen can. It can get through that lipid layer, no problem. All right, so here I see an arrow with oxygen entering the cell right here. That's a good thing because mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP for us. All right, so how, and we're talking about diffusion. So where is oxygen at a high concentration, inside the cell or outside the cell? And it's important that you see that. Kind of a trick question, okay, because cells need oxygen. You would think, well, gee whiz, then oxygen should be at a high concentration inside the cell because you need it to stay alive. But if oxygen were at a high concentration inside the cell compared to outside, which way would oxygen go? It would leave the cell. Okay? That's not what we want to happen. All right, so you got to change your thinking a little bit. And then those mitochondria produce CO2. CO2 can go across the plasma membrane. And then we see it on this diagram over here. We have CO2 leaving the cell, going into the air, right, because we exhale that from our bodies. Where is CO2 at a high concentration? If this is what? Diffusion right here. Is it high in the atmosphere, or is carbon dioxide high inside your body? Again, kind of a trick question. It's high where? Inside the cell. High inside your body, right? Because if the carbon dioxide was high in the atmosphere, then which way would carbon dioxide go? It would enter your body. It would never leave. So we're fortunate that our atmosphere almost has zero concentration of carbon dioxide in the air, right? It's way less than 1%. Way less than a tenth of a percent, probably way less than a tenth of a percent. So carbon dioxide really kind of just rushes right out of your body because there's a big concentration gradient. The bigger the concentration gradient, the faster the rate of diffusion. We're going to take a look at that. All right, so here is that nice cell membrane. You can see these phospholipids. This is, you can consider this the phospholipid bilayer. So polar compounds can't get through this lipid world on the interior part of the membrane. So charged compounds, like how would you talk about a charged compound, a charged molecule? It's a, yeah, electrolyte, okay, but it has what? Electrolytes have an electrical charge on them, right? Could you give me an example? Sodium, how would you talk about sodium as being an electrolyte or an ion? How many charges does it have? One, two, three. It's got one, so we call it what? Monovalent, since it only has one charge. That's the term that you should consider that. All right, and what kind of ion is it? Because it can be a positive or negative charge. You should know what that's called. That's a cation. It's a monovalent cation, right? Sodium. Same thing for potassium. Chloride, on the other hand, is a monovalent anion, has a negative charge. Those compounds cannot get through the cell membrane because of the lipids on the interior part. All right, so these charged molecules have to have an ion channel or a transporter to move them across the membrane. So I see some proteins embedded in this membrane right here, and then so we should modify our understanding of the plasma membrane. It's just not a simple phospholipid bilayer, but other proteins are added to it. So the best way to think of a plasma membrane is with the fluid mosaic model. Other things are added to the phospholipid bilayer to give special functions to the membrane. So here is a channel, and it's a special kind of channel because here we see that it is closed at this particular time. And then if we look at this channel down over here, we see it's open. And these proteins can change their state. They can open and close, some of them. And if they can open or close, we call it a gated channel. If it's open all the time, then it's not a gated channel. We might even consider it a pore, for instance, where it's open all the time. So here we see some solute molecules, okay, and in the extracellular fluid, would you say that we have more or less compared to the intracellular fluid? Yeah, there are more. Since you have a high concentration and low concentration, which way are these molecules going to move when this gate is opened? They're going to rush inside the cell because of the concentration gradient, okay? And when this gate is closed, can they move across the membrane? They cannot, right? So what can you tell me about this membrane right here? Is it permeable to everything or selectively permeable? It's selectively permeable, and the cell determines when this gate opens up or closes. And we're going to look at some really nifty conditions that show that. All right, so diffusion. Let's characterize diffusion a little bit. The rate of diffusion is directly related to the magnitude of the concentration gradient, or the how big it is. If when the concentration gradient goes to zero, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It stops, right? It just stops. The permeability of the membrane to a particular molecule is very important. If the membrane's impermeable, what happens to transport across the membrane? Can't happen, right? It's got to be permeable. Temperature influences the rate of diffusion, and the surface area of the membrane influences the rate of diffusion. So let's write down, okay, in an algebraic form what this means. So we have diffusion. I'm just going to say the rate of diffusion, I'm just going to say capital D over here, is going to be equal to something, all right? And then I'm going to put a little dividing line. What goes in the numerator of this fraction that we're writing on the board? Everything that is directly related to diffusion. Okay, which is what? Concentration gradient. Maybe I'll just put a delta right here for concentration gradient. Means the concentration is different in two places. Permeability. Maybe I'll just put a P right here for permeability. If permeability increases, what happens to rate of diffusion? It increases. If the concentration gradient increases, what happens to diffusion? Yeah, it's faster, it increases. If the concentration gradient decreases, what happens to the rate? Yeah, so if something is directly related, we put it in the numerator. If this goes up, so does that. If this, any of these terms go down, what happens to the rate? It goes down as well. What else we got? Temperature. Temperature increases, what happens to the rate? Since it's directly related, it goes up. And surface area. All right, so I'll just put a S right there. If the surface area increases, if the doorway for exchange increases, so does diffusion. All right, but there are some things that are inversely related. And one parameter is molecular weight, which is related to the size of the compound. How big a compound it is, how heavy it is inversely related. So do we want to put that in the numerator here? We do not. We want to put it down here in the denominator. So let's just say molecular weight. MW is a term. So here, if these parameters increase, so does diffusion. But if molecular weight increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? Since it's inversely related, it goes down. All right? So think in terms of that nice, simple algebraic equation. Okay. Oh, I do want my cursor back. Really bad. How do we get it back? Okay. I don't know how many slides did I go over. Ah, that's it. Okay, so that's diffusion. Another term that you have to be familiar with is osmosis. All right, now, let's go back and revisit a concept, and that is of a solution. What does a solution have by definition? Solvent plus a solute, right? It has to be a solution. All right, so that's going to be an important consideration for... Oh, it's just not working because my cursor disappeared again. Sorry. Okay. So there are three important criteria, right, that have to be satisfied in order for a process to be osmosis. And I want you to be really familiar with those. All right, so we're going to talk about what osmosis really is. So let's consider a couple experiments. Okay. Well, first with a definition. It's the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. That's the definition of osmosis. But we're going to have to dissect that, analyze it a little bit. All right, so if it's diffusion, what the heck does that mean? That's kind of a loaded term. Does it require energy? No, it's a passive process, right? You don't need ATP. Okay. And how does a molecule move if it's diffusion? From high concentration to low concentration. All right, and water. It's only the diffusion of water. And what kind of molecule is water in terms of a solution? Water is the solvent, okay? So in order for something to be osmosis, it has to be the solvent molecule. And in biology, that is always going to be water, okay? So it's going to be the diffusion of water, and it's got to go across some kind of membrane in order for it to be osmosis. And the membrane has to have a certain quality so that it allows water to go across, but not everything, not every kind of solute, right? So those three things make it osmosis. So let's just take a look at some of these things. All right, so water diffusing down its concentration gradient, that's just diffusion, right? So if we look at this example over here, we see two chambers with a membrane between it. So it's looking good that this is going to be an illustration of what kind of process? Osmosis, because we have a membrane right here. And then if we zoom into this membrane, we can see that the membrane has certain pores. We have little holes in the membrane, but they're not big holes. They're tiny, tiny little holes. And I see that this has some water molecules, and it's got some bigger molecules dissolved in water. So how would you characterize this material over here? This is a solution because it's got solvent and it's got solute. And what kind of molecules can fit across this membrane can fit through this pore right here. Only water, because it's small enough to fit through, but not the solute molecule. It's too big, right? All right, so on this particular example, let's put just a couple solute molecules and a lot of water, and then over here, a lot of solute and maybe not so much water. So which way is this solute going to want to move? It's going to want to move to the left, but can it? No, it's trapped over here, can't get through this membrane. So we say it is osmotically active when that happens. Kind of a loaded term. I'll describe it in a little bit more detail later. All right, but now on the left-hand side, we have a lot of water. All right, a lesser concentration on the right. All right, so what about water? Can it move across the membrane? Yeah, because it's high concentration on one side, low on the other, and it has the right dimension to fit through this pore right here. All right, so we have a selectively permeable membrane that's moving. Water is diffusing because it's going from high to low, doesn't require any energy. And since water is the solvent molecule, this is an example of osmosis, right? So osmosis is just a special condition of diffusion, right? It's still passive, but you got to have this selectively permeable membrane in it. Okay, what's the next one? Osmotic pressure. All right, so osmotic pressure can develop if you have some osmotically active solute molecules in solution. So here we have a chamber, and it's separated into two compartments with this membrane right here. And this is going to be a selectively permeable membrane, so it's going to let water molecule move across because it's small, but not these solute molecules. They can't move across. Does this solute molecule want to move over here to the left? Absolutely. But it can't because this is a selectively permeable membrane. All right, so over here we have no solute, just pure water. So this is a high concentration of water, low concentration of water here. So which way is water going to want to move? It's going to want to move from the left into the right, right, to equalize the concentration of water in each of these compartments over here. And then when water moves over, right, if this barrier right here, it can slide back and forth. Think of this maybe as being like a piston in your car, right? And the piston goes up and down. It slides within the wall of the cylinder. Let's just say that this membrane can slide back and forth so that when water moves over here, what happens to the position of this membrane? It's got to move, right, to take into account that molecule over here. And if you got millions or billions of water molecules moving over here, it's going to push this membrane way back over to the side, way over to the left, to make space for all those water molecules moving over. All right, so when water molecules move, it will push on this membrane right here, and we call that osmotic pressure. And we can measure the osmotic pressure by putting some force on this little connecting rod right here to the membrane and measure how much force we need to push the membrane back to its original position. That's osmotic pressure. Right, so think of this as being a cell, and this is the cell membrane, right, of a cell. So this pressure is proportional to the solute concentration. Remember, there would be no osmotic pressure developing if there were no solutes over here, right? Because if water had the same concentration on each side, there would be what? No net diffusion of it, right? If the concentration is the same, no net diffusion. All right, so that's osmotic pressure. That's really important. We're going to consider that a lot in this class. Okay, let's talk about some ways that we can measure the concentration of the solute that's in a solution. There are two ways to do that, actually three important ways to do that. Okay, so here we have a beaker. We're going to put some stuff in here. We're going to make a solution. What are the two things we need to make a solution? Solvent and a solute. The solvent we're going to use is water. So this line represents exactly 1 liter of volume inside of this flask, and the same on this flask over here. That signifies exactly 1 liter. That's a volume. Okay, so we're going to, in this particular case, right, to measure the molarity of a solution, right, we take 1 mole of a solute molecule and dissolve it in water, right, and so we measure out 1 mole of a compound, and some of you haven't really taken chemistry, but we can figure out what the molecular weight of glucose is by counting how many carbon atoms there are in glucose. And you should probably know there are how many? There are six. And then we can then figure out what the weight of each one of those carbons is by looking at the periodic table, right? And we take that number that's in the periodic table and multiply it by six, because glucose has six carbons. But glucose has more than carbons in it. It also has what? It has hydrogen and oxygen. So then we count up the number of oxygens that are in glucose, multiplied by the number that's in the periodic table, right? And then add that to the carbon, and then we got to do the same thing for the hydrogens that are in glucose, and then we get the weight of this many particles, 10 to the 23rd. That's a huge number. I don't even know what it is, right? Nobody really knows what it is. So what do we call that? We call that 1 mole of atoms, or we can say 1 Avogadro's number, different ways of talking about it. But it's so huge, right? We just define this to be a mole of particles. All right, so we put 1 mole of glucose into this container right here, and then we add water to it, and the amount of water that we add, right, will bring the solution exactly up to this 1 liter mark. And then we have the molar concentration of glucose in solution right here. But there's another way to make a solution up. Instead of molarity, we call it molality. That's the second example. We still take 1 mole of glucose, right, and we can calculate what that is. All it tells you right here, it's 180 grams. So you know what? Write down for yourself, and it's a problem at the end of the chapter, a quantitative problem. Make sure that you can calculate what the molecular weight of glucose, what 1 mole would actually weigh. I think in chemistry now they call that the gram molecular weight of a compound. Right? Make sure that you can get to 180 grams. If you can't, see me during office hours or talk to your lab instructor. So we take 180 grams, right, put it in this beaker or this flask right here, and then instead of filling the flask to exactly 1 liter, we're going to take 1 liter of water and add it to the glucose that we put in here. So what's the total volume now? Okay, it's going to be over 1 liter because now there's glucose in there as well, plus the 1 liter of water. So it's a little bit more. So that's a molar solution. All right, so there are different ways to talking about concentration, and you got to be familiar with the difference between molarity and molality. And the solutions are made up a little bit different. All right, but now, some solute molecules that we have on our body, okay, when we put them in solution, they don't remain a single molecule. They break apart. We call that dissociation. Could you give me an example of a molecule when it's dry, it's just a single molecule, but when we put it in water, it dissociates. It may form 2 or 3 different molecules. Give me an example of one that breaks down into 2. Like NaCl, salt, table salt. So it has those 2 compounds. It's an ionic bond, right? It's relatively weak. You put it in water, that ionic bond breaks. And we need to talk about the concentration then of solute in that solution. Right, which is this next slide over here. We call that osmolality, because how this membrane slides back and forth is not due to the molarity or molality, it's due to the osmolality, which just means the number of particles that are in solution, not the type of particles, you know, the color, the charge, or anything else, but just the plain old number. So if we put NaCl in water, it's going to dissociate, so you really have twice the number of particles in solution compared to what you think you put in, right? Because of dissociation. All right, so osmolality is the total molality of the solution because some things dissociate. So 1 molal solution of NaCl yields a 2 osmolar solution because sodium chloride dissociates into these 2 compartments over here. So let's look at this illustration that we have. We have 2 compartments. They have exact same volume, which we're going to say is X. And in this first compartment over here, we're going to put a 1 molal solution of glucose. What about glucose when we put it in solution? Does it break apart? You know what? It doesn't. It just dissolves, right? It doesn't break apart. But if we put sodium chloride in solution, what happens? You get twice the number of particles, right? So over here, right, even though it's a 1 molar solution, after it dissociates, that becomes a 2 osmolar solution. All right, and let's just say that glucose can't get through the membrane, and sodium can't get through the membrane, nor can chloride. So glucose and sodium and chloride ions are what we call what? It's kind of, I slipped that in. And I don't want to have it just slip by you, but I slipped it in lecture. What do we call a solute molecule that can't get through the membrane right here? How do we consider that molecule? It becomes osmotically active. Right, so if water can move across the membrane, but these solute molecules can't, it becomes osmotically active. All right, so that means osmotic pressure can develop. So this solution over here is twice as concentrated in solute compared to the left-hand side. So which way is water going to move? Water is at a higher concentration on the left, less concentration on the right. So water is going to move from left to right. And when it does, it's going to push that semipermeable membrane to the left, right? Because these particles are osmotically active. They can't get through the cell membrane. Okay, so then what happens? As water moves over here, the concentration of NaCl decreases, the concentration of glucose on the other side increases, but what can you tell me about the water concentration? They are the same, all right? And when that happens, when water concentration is the same, then this membrane stops moving, and then it's at equilibrium, and that happens when it's a 1.5 osmolar solution on the left and a 1.5 osmolar solution on the right. Okay, and that's because why? Sodium and chloride don't stay together when we put it in solution. They break apart. All right, so the number of solute particles for a certain volume is equal to the number of solute particles over here for that same volume. And that's what we're measuring with osmolality, the number of particles for a certain volume. Could be a milliliter or a liter or whatever volume that you would like. All right, but the molarity is what? Or the molality is different because of dissociation. All right, that brings us to some important considerations of tonicity. All right, tonicity is the effect that a solution has on the movement of water, the osmotic movement of water. And we've got a couple terms right here, isotonic, hypertonic, and hypotonic, that you have to be aware of. All right, and I just want to draw it on the board. These slides are pretty good, but let's just work these problems on the board. Let's see, what slide number is that? Does it say number 19? Okay, we're almost done for today, but not quite. Okay. Let's take a couple beakers, and here's a beaker right here. Hopefully, can you guys in the back see that beaker pretty well? Okay, here's another beaker right here, another beaker right here, and we're going to put different kinds of solutions in these beakers right here, and also a cell. All right, so here's a cell. What kind of cell does that look like? Because I'm a great artist. I should give you an extra credit point on a test if you say that. Okay, that is a red blood cell. Okay, and all cells have a certain concentration of salt inside them, or solute inside these cells. And we're going to say the solute concentration in each one of these cells right here is 0.9% solute or salt. So I'll put NaCl right here. NaCl. So if it's 0.9% solute inside the cell, what's the water concentration? Yeah, so we're going to say 99.1%, what, H2O right here. What about this cell right here? 99.1% H2O, right? 99.1% H2O, and what, 0.9% salt, 0.9% salt. Because that's what a living cell has inside of it, pretty much by definition. All right, so let's put this cell inside a beaker that just has plain old water in it, just H2O. So how much water, what's the percentage of water now that's inside this beaker? It's 100% H2O right here. And what's it inside inside the cell? 99. Water can move across this cell membrane. Okay, at least this particular cell. Not all the cells of your body, but most water can move across the membrane. Will water want to move one way or the other? It's going to go from high to low. Where is it higher? Outside the cell. It's low inside the cell, right, compared to the outside. So water is going to move in. It doesn't look like a big concentration gradient to me, all right? But as water moves in, what happens to this cell right here? Does it get bigger or smaller or stay the same? You know what? It's going to get bigger as a result, okay? And it's going to get so big, even though the concentration gradient is very small, it's going to break apart. It's going to just fill up like a balloon, and it's going to burst, all right? And since it's a red blood cell, we call that hemolysis. All right, or we say the cell lyses or hemolyzes. So even that small difference in concentration of water is going to destroy that cell. And so we call this solution right here, the solution that we put the cell in to blow it up like that, hypotonic. All right, so a hypotonic solution will cause hemolysis. And that cell destroys. So if you get a transfusion, if you get an injection of a drug or something, or an IV, all right, and if it's just plain water, what's going to happen to your red blood cells? They're just all going to explode. Okay, so you never want to do that to a patient, right? All right, so then let's go over to this condition over here. Let's put this red blood cell in like salt water, seawater. And in this particular case, let's just say that it is 5% salt. How much water? Yeah, it's going to be then 95% H2O. All right, and is water going to move across the cell membrane by a concentration gradient? Okay, it is. And which way is it going to go? From high concentration to low. All right, and which one has higher concentration of water, inside the cell or outside the cell? Inside the cell. So I think you're saying water is going to leave from high to low, right? And indeed, you're right. Water is going to come out. Now, what's going to happen to this cell right here? Yeah, the cell is going to shrink, right? Because water is leaving. It's going to get all shriveled up like that. So nice, instead of a nice, smooth, continuous membrane, it's going to look like that. Okay, and this kind of solution, okay, or I have hemolysis here, this process is what we call crenation. That is crenation. This cell is just going to shrink up. It's going to crenate. All right, so the way that we talk about this solution that causes crenation, we say that that solution is hypertonic. Hypertonic. And this one over here is what? Hypotonic. All right, so now let's talk about this solution right here. Yeah, I think we're doing pretty good. So let's put this red blood cell in a special solution that is 0.9% salt, which means how much water is in there? 99.1%, right? Because here's a little decimal point, water. All right, now where is water at a higher concentration, outside the cell or inside the cell? Aha, I've tricked some of you. It's actually what? It's exactly the same. So which way is water going to diffuse? It's not. It's going to diffuse in, but the same amount is going to diffuse out. Remember, no net diffusion of water. So what about the shape of this cell right here in this beaker? It's going to stay the same. This solution that's matched exactly to the intracellular compartment is what we call isotonic. Iso meaning the same. It exerts the same osmotic pressure on the membrane on the inside and on the outside. The membrane doesn't move. So if you get a transfusion of something, what kind of solution do you think you should be transfused with or injected with? A hypotonic, an isotonic, or hypertonic? Isotonic. Okay? Which means that the water has to be at this percent right here. All right, so that's really important. So if you get into a car accident and paramedics decide to maintain your blood pressure, your cardiac function, they'll give you some fluids on the way to the hospital, an IV of some fluids. Guess what that fluid has to be? isotonic. It has to have some solutes in there, okay, in order so that those cells don't explode. All right, a little bit of difference between a hypertonic and hypotonic solution when applied to cells. All right, what happened to this cell right here? Can you ever get this cell back again? It's blown up. This is an irreversible process, okay? Those cells are just lysed. Now, crenation is sort of interesting because you can get this cell back, right, once it's been crenated by taking this cell and placing it where? In an isotonic solution. If you take this cell and put it in a water solution, what's going to happen to it? It's going to hemolyze, right? So this is not an irreversible process. So when you become a little dehydrated, just a little dehydrated, if you rehydrate a person, they can kind of get back to normal. Their cells can. All right, so that's sort of important. And that's what this next diagram here shows. Okay. So here you have a normal red blood cell. And if you put it in a hypotonic solution, it will expand. It will get bigger. Right, but you can see even just a little change in the water concentration, this cell will lyse, it will explode. You'll probably do that experiment in lab if you haven't already. Or if you put this cell in a hypertonic solution, it's going to get all spiky and shrunken down. Have you done this in physiology yet? This week? No, probably one of these days, one of these weeks you will. All right, so that is why maintaining fluid balance inside your body is so important and actually produces some really weird results as well. All right, for instance, can you overdose on water? Absolutely. There have been a lot of interesting cases in the last 10 years on the radio and TV that I've heard. There was a contest for winning a pickup truck, and a whole bunch of people got together. It's produced by a radio station, and they said, whoever drinks as much water as you can will win the pickup truck. A lot of really excited people when that happened, right? Because a pickup truck is, I don't know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. I don't know how much it was, and you can use it to go to work and make money, that kind of stuff. Right, so there was this one person that drank a lot of water, and her GI tract absorbed all of this water, but what happened to the cells in her body? They started to expand because of all that water, which might not be too big. Sometimes your hands are puffy, your hand gets big, maybe if you're overhydrated, but there's one particular part of your body that can't expand because it's held within this armor plating, this vault. What is that? Your brain. So what happened to this poor person was that her brain started to expand, all right, but it has no place to go, but there's one place where it can go. Actually, a couple little minor places, but one big place. Where could her brain go? Down through the foramen magnum into the spinal cord. It's gruesome, and it was really, really gruesome. So she drank all this water. There was a nurse at the competition, and the nurse said, you know what, you got to get to the emergency room right away. And this woman said, no, I need that pickup truck to feed my family. Okay, so it was a really tough decision for her. Finally ended up in the emergency room, but it was too late. All right, so this is really important. You can overdose on water. Okay, so I wanted to give you another example, but I forgot, but I'll take a question.
If you ate something like a lot of salt when that was happening, would that help reverse the effect?
Yeah, but probably not fast enough in her case. Okay, so, just a corollary to this. So, for instance, if your baby is dehydrated or you're dehydrated, all right, should you just force a lot of fluids on somebody? What's the best thing to give somebody? Okay, isotonic solution, where can you buy that in the grocery store? It's called what? It's called Pedialyte, yeah, which is an isotonic solution. All right, so you can rehydrate somebody without worrying about going too far, right, and causing expansion of tissues and some of these other weird circumstances that can happen. All right, there are some pharmaceutical agents that aren't over the counter that trigger your brain to think that you're dying of thirst. Okay? And if you think you're dying of thirst, what do you have a tendency to do? Drink a lot of water. So ecstasy is the short name for it. Sometimes can trigger inside your brain the sensation that you're thirsty, all right? And there have been a couple water overdoses for people that have been on ecstasy, because sometimes you're out in the desert where it's really hot, you're sweating a lot, so you have a tendency to think consciously that what? You're dehydrating, and then you have this overwhelming sense that you're dehydrated, And it's, again, very easy to overdose on water when that happens. All right, so it's an important property. So we're very interested in maintaining homeostasis. How does your body maintain water homeostasis inside your body? Okay, so I don't know if this is an exam figure, but this would probably be a good one. Let's analyze this in terms of a response loop that you've learned before. Right, so blood osmolality is maintained within a narrow range suitable to support life, and that number is about 300 milliosmolar is the water concentration or salt solute concentration inside your body. Right, if dehydration occurs, there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, so you have sensors inside your brain that say that can monitor what your water balance is. All right. So if dehydration occurs, then your body becomes what? More salty or less salty? More salty. And as a result, the hypothalamus will stimulate the release of antidiuretic hormone. Sometimes we spend a lot of time in anatomy on this, but antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, comes from the posterior pituitary. All right, so we're going to learn some about, we'll make sure that we know that at the end of this class. All right, there are other hormones from the anterior pituitary, but ADH and oxytocin come from the posterior pituitary. And that's a hormone, so it goes, it travels in the blood, it's released into the blood, it goes everywhere in the body, and it goes to the kidney. The kidney can respond to ADH because the kidney has a receptor for that particular signaling compound. Right, and it causes the body to conserve water. Right, so you're going to produce very minimal amounts of urine that are highly concentrated. Right, so a small volume of urine, which means that you're holding water inside your body and it's very concentrated. But ADH also causes the sensation of thirst. So what are you going to do when you're thirsty? Drink something. What's the effect on the osmolality of your body then when you drink water? It's going to go down. Okay, so that's what this illustration here says. All right, so when you're dehydrated, blood volume decreases. That's maybe a new concept for you, but that's true. Your blood volume actually decreases because you're losing water, and plasma osmolality increases. That stimulates the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus then tells you you're thirsty. You're going to drink some water, so you intake your water intake. And as you take water, as you drink, what happens to the, how does that stimulus, I'm sorry, this is the response, when you drink water, that's the response, how does that correspond to the initial stimulus? It subtracts, yeah, it subtracts from the stimulus, so what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop. Let's look at the other leg over here. All right, so the hypothalamus then tells the posterior pituitary to release antidiuretic hormone, which goes to the kidney, and it forces the kidney to stop excreting water. Okay, so water retention increases. So you retain water inside your body. That feeds back to the initial stimulus. In which way? Does it add or subtract from the initial stimulus? That subtracts from the stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. And what do negative feedback loops in your body normally produce? What does it lead to? Homeostasis, right? So it doesn't mean that your water and salt concentration is exactly the same. It can go up or down, but it always goes back to the set point if it's a negative feedback loop, and that maintains homeostasis inside your body. All right, so I guess this is a really good place to stop. Membrane transport systems, which means we got to finish the rest of this slide. One last thing I want to tell you before you go. Two things. Sign-in sheet is going around, and then there's a really, like, idiotic way to remember hemolysis and hypotonic crenation and hypertension, all right, which is, if you can figure it out, that's really good, but there's a really simple way to remember this so that even if you have to give this lecture in 25 years from now, and you don't study it in between, now in 25 years, you'll be able to remember how it goes. And you want to hear this idiotic trick? As long as you don't tell anybody that I taught this to you, okay? No problem? Yeah, it's okay. Look, here is a nice O in hemolysis. Here's a nice O in hypotonic. Here is a nice E in crenation. And what do you got right here? A nice E in hypertonic. All right, so, but you should understand the mechanism, but if you want to double check, make sure you select the right answer on the test. Just look for O and O and E and E. and that will help you. Okay? Okay. See you Thursday.
Hey, Andy.